CEFM in Fairbanks. It's 7 o'clock and time now for Home Fires. Tonight's program marks the return of the prodigal daughter. Host Patty Kostelic.
And good evening on this frosty Saturday. I'm very glad to be back. I'm nervous. I always tell my guests, pretend that you're in a friend's house, in a friend's living room, talking about something that's very interesting to you, and just absolutely relax. I will do all the worrying and the panicking, and I'm doing it. Probably I'm particularly nervous because I haven't done this in a while. I wonder, are you all still out there, and did you have a good summer? We're going to talk about gardening and preserving the fruits of the earth tonight because that's one of my favorite subjects, and I thought we should start with an easy one. But I'm going to ask for a lot of help from you. I want to know how you enjoyed the summer. I want to know how your gardens were. And I think it's a particularly timely evening to share our green tomato recipes. So I please urge you to call me tonight, 474-5044. I want to know if you're still out there. I want to know what you thought of some of the programs this summer with my wonderful guest hosts that were on. I understand that people really enjoyed some of those programs, and I'd like to hear from you about those. And I would also like your help in planning the fall. I would like your suggestions on what you'd like me to do in the way of finding guests and see who you would suggest and what subjects you would suggest. Okay, we're going to start out. I don't know how many of you listen to All Things Considered on a regular basis, but there was a lovely bit. We seem to have a lot of experts in every field these days. And this was an outside expert giving advice on the subject that we're going to discuss tonight, how you preserve the fruits of the earth. My guest did not hear this, and so we'll get her reaction after she's heard it for the first time. So without further ado, let's go to this wonderful little piece on how to can.
Something that never goes out of fashion is fresh produce. This time of year, summer gardeners try to preserve the fruit and vegetables of their labor in canning jars. Commentator Vic Sussman is among those who've attempted to save a little bit of summer by the open kettle method. Shows you what I know.
That's a big enamelware pot over which you'll finally get a chance to recite bubble, bubble, toil and trouble. You'll also need jars, jar lids, a jar lifter, a slotted spoon, a spatula, timer, cooling racks, wide mouth funnel, razor sharp knives, gallons of boiling water, and your Blue Cross card. Pack the jars and process them for the correct time, which you'll find in your canning reference chart. Let's see, process tomatoes for 45 minutes quarts or 35 minutes pints, adding 2 minutes for every additional 1,000 feet of altitude, or 10 minutes if your brother is an orthodontist. This is too complicated. Here's my system. I boil the jars until my wallpaper unrolls or my sinuses clog from the humidity. Canning is a bit more complicated, however, if you're going to preserve vegetables, dairy products, or meat. These low-acid foods can spoil and produce botulism, a fatal food poison. Botulism has military value because it kills people without destroying property, but it can ruin a family picnic. So you'll need a pressure canner, which cooks food at 240 degrees Fahrenheit. Pressure canners have pressure gauges that should be tested for accuracy. If the gauge reads too low, the pot may explode, instantly redecorating your kitchen ceiling and scaring your dog. If the gauge reads too high, your succotash will violate the Geneva Convention on Germ Warfare. So have your gauge tested by your Agriculture Extension Service. But maybe you'd rather freeze your vegetables. Freezing is easy. All you need is $600 to buy a freezer and $100 worth of nuclear-generated electricity, and you too can live the simple life. Wait a minute. What about drying food? Even primitive people who don't have blow dryers know how to dry food, right? Slice the vegetables thinly and dry them in the sun or an electric food dryer. Your vegetables are ready when they look like something found in King Tut's tomb. Did you know that you can fit 75 dried tomatoes in a quart jar? And after you taste them, you'll want to keep them in the jar. But maybe I've discouraged you, and you want to forget your kitchen full of vegetables and go out for a pizza. Heresy. What would Henry Thoreau say? How about, easy on the pepperoni, Waldo?
The comments of Vic Sussman from Westburg, Vermont.
Well, not to be outdone by the experts in Vermont, I have with me our own expert, Ellen Iote, the district home economist from the Cooperative Extension Service. And Ellen was with me last year and gives wonderful advice. But it's not just our advice that I want to hear tonight. I really would like you to go and dig out those green tomato recipes and call in and share them with us. And our number is 474-5044, or any other timely advice you have on what to do about putting foods by here at this scurrying time. I mean, it really... Needless to say, I was on the river today, on the river boat, and the weather is just less than divine. The tourists were horrified. We are, of course, all acting very stoic, like, oh, well, wait. It's going to get worse. That's not good for the gardens. What have you done? You want to make me feel bad, Ellen? What have you put up so far, personally, in your garden? What have you got already preserved and neatly in jars?
I just got back from vacation, so I'm going to be busy tonight. Maybe what you need to do first is read the weather forecast, and then maybe everybody will be up all night long gathering the harvests from their garden. Huh?
One of the first things Ellen tells me on these wonderfully organized notes she handed me is that it's best to bring the things in before they freeze, not after. Freezing in the garden is not the preferred method, and tonight they are calling for a few snow showers, some west wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. No, tonight 25 miles per hour with gusts to 35, lows in the mid-30s. Now, I have already had, we got sort of a nipping frost on the top of the potatoes on August 10th, and we've been covering up, the front yard is sort of a sea of visqueen, and we've been sort of covering and uncovering ever since then. But Thursday night, definitely the dahlias, the beans, the squash, and the potatoes got a sort of final frosting. And tomorrow night, Sunday, they're calling for a hard frost, low in the upper 20s. So that means that despite the fact that everything's soggy out there, we should really get it in tomorrow at the latest, right?
So people really need to start harvesting, and then when you harvest, you're going to be busy. So you probably should have some help doing it. For many of the vegetables, you have several choices of which method of food preservation to use. I don't know what's your favorite. Some vegetables, of course, you would not can because of the texture, and others you probably wouldn't freeze. So we can just list some vegetables and then get some ideas how you might preserve them if you like to do that, or however you want to proceed.
Yeah. That's
potatoes probably, and we will be having another guest here shortly that we'll talk more about food storage. Potatoes, you have a couple choices. Probably just storing them in a dark, cool place would certainly be my choice. However, if you don't have that place, then you can can them. However, potatoes canned is not my favorite way to preserve them. Or you can go ahead and freeze them, but they don't freeze very well unless you make hash browns out of them or French fries. Commercially, they can do a lot of things that you can't do in your home situation. So if you want to freeze potatoes, either hash browns or French fries are the best. My first choice for storage of potatoes would be to store them. That would be my
method.
It seems
like a lot of work making French fries and then freezing them.
Right. Well, you partially cook them. You don't completely cook them, and then they're ready to go. So with potatoes, you have a number of choices of things that you can go ahead and do.
Can't we just leave them in the ground for a week or two here while getting in the rest of the
stuff?
Sure, and
this is what I was saying. Probably harvest all of those things first that are above ground and that are going to be nipped. And then when you have a little bit more time, go ahead and harvest the things that are under the ground, because it's going to be a while before the ground freezes deep enough that will actually damage those vegetables.
Okay, let's start in an orderly way then. We'll leave the underground things in and wait for Gale.
That's right.
And we're going to start above the ground. First and foremost, this year we have had a really not very conducive to tomato ripening August, and so we have a lot of green tomatoes. What are we going to do with those?
Well, you can use them. I had a lady call the other day where her green tomatoes were nipped, and so I suggested that she definitely harvest those and do something with them. She wanted to store them so they would ripen. That's not a possibility. Once they have been nipped by frost, they're just going to spoil. So I suggested that she cut them up and make things out of the green tomatoes at that period in time, and then pull the plants and hang them up in her garage and let them ripen that way. Or, Gail, maybe you have some other suggestions how you would ripen green tomatoes, since we're going to have to ripen a lot of them, I think.
We've just been joined for our audience's benefit by Gail Mayo. She's an avid experienced gardener, and she's got a root cellar, and she's a 4-H leader, and she's going to share with us some of her methods.
Okay, I'm not sure I got everything Ellen mentioned. Did you mention wrapping them?
No. The only thing I just suggested, first of all, if they're nipped by the frost, the green tomatoes, they certainly will not keep and ripen because they're going to spoil. So you need to do something with those immediately. But then the ones that are not nipped by the frost, I suggest pulling the plants and hanging them in a fairly warm garage. And then why don't you get some other ideas of things
well, that
you can do.
Hanging the plants is our favorite method.
Okay.
But it also works well to pick the tomatoes and put them in maybe a fruit tray that you've gotten from the grocery store, where each tomato can be in a separate little compartment, and they keep for an amazingly long time. But actually, what we like best is to make green tomato chutney, and so we don't keep ours too long.
Did you bring your recipe by any chance?
No, I didn't.
Okay, audience, 474-5044. I cannot believe there isn't somebody out there with a wonderful green tomato chutney recipe to call in and share with us. Or anything else, green tomato relish? Are you out there? 474-5044.
We do have a book, with some recipes we can send people. I don't know that there's a chutney recipe in here. There's green tomato bread. Green tomato pie, by the way, is excellent. It tastes kind of like green apple pie, and I think is very good.
They call
ketchup
it mock and, apple.
Yeah, relishes and mincemeat and lots of other things.
One trick I learned about green tomatoes from a lady in New Hampshire was that she sliced them and froze them without any other preparation, and then she thawed them out and used them in casseroles and pizzas, and they were very much like green peppers.
Really?
They were
slicing
just
them?
Delicious.
And then just freezing them. No.
Yeah, so they were ready to use as soon as they came from the freezer. Because they're kind of mushy then, but they're still very delicious.
And having cut them before, then you don't if they freeze faster, and then, of course, you don't have to manipulate them very much after they've thawed out.
And apparently they're one of the few things that doesn't need a pre-blanching or whatever because of their acid content, I suppose.
Well, green peppers don't either, but many of the other vegetables should be blanched prior to freezing.
Well, I actually really like fried green tomatoes, and we had some the other day, and those are sort of nice treat at this time of this time of year. I have a friend who actually likes fried green tomatoes better than he likes ripe tomatoes.
An Alaskan, for sure.
Actually, that's right. He comes from Idaho, but he's been here a long time, and I think that's probably true. Now, I'm from Illinois, and I think that the big red ones are the best. But
well, we're hoping. We have probably more ripe tomatoes this year than we've ever had. It's amazing. So we had ripe tomatoes tonight for dinner, so hopefully we won't have a lot of green tomatoes we're going to have to worry about.
It didn't hurt that you were gone for a while.
No, we had someone manning the garden, so probably that was why it did very well this year.
Well,
another thing, of course, that frost seems to hit first are the green beans. And if anybody has any green beans left at all, boy, tonight I think they better get out there and harvest them. You can either can green beans. Again, you have to use a pressure cooker because it's a low-acid vegetable. Or you can go ahead and freeze them, and you need to blanch them first.
I like pickled green beans.
And
I think
you like pickle. Okay, great.
Excellent way to do. Sam's mother, Mary Ellen's, visiting us, and she did several quarts. And Sam, while you're listening to the radio show, you maybe should go out and pick up those rest of those green beans that are out there before it gets dark.
Do you have your recipe for pickled green beans? It sounds good, and I just picked a couple of gallons of them.
Actually, the recipe I use is in the pickling book from the Extension Service.
Okay.
There's a little white book.
I didn't bring it tonight.
But at any rate, it's at the Extension Service, and it's on pickling, and it has a recipe for pickled green beans, and it's excellent, and I've shared it with friends and family in Illinois, and they're using it, and they think it's a great recipe, too. I don't know whose it is, so 474-5044. I really would like to hear from you. They're probably all out in the garden. Now we've really panicked them in. grabbing those green tomato plants by the roots.
We talked a little bit about potatoes, Gail. How do you store your potatoes? We said they can wait. They can wait maybe a week, get the other stuff in first. But after you dig them out of the ground, what do you do then?
Well, we have been storing potatoes in a root cellar for quite a long time, and I know that the recommendation is to just let the potatoes dry, not to wash them before letting them dry, but let them dry in a room temperature room for, isn't it, a week? At any rate, it's a process called conditioning, and it toughens the skin so that the potatoes store better. But we've found that our potatoes store better if we wash them very carefully so we don't, damage that young skin. So we hose the potatoes off, and then we dry them at room temperature for a week or so. And at that point, sort through them.
So you bring them in and fill up your living room and your hallways with potatoes. Because actually, we got quite a large potato crop last year, and we had some good weather, so we had them outside, and it was warm, and they dried nicely out there.
Yeah,
but this
I think
year, that won't.
If you harvested them early enough so you had some nice weather, you could certainly do it outside and avoid the living room hallway bit.
But not this year, I'm afraid. Doesn't look like.
Well, not today. This might help with the washing the dirt off them.
Okay. But you have to wash them gently so that you don't nick that.
Yeah, and I think that's why it is recommended that you don't wash them, is probably because it would be easier to damage the skins, and then they don't store well at all. But we just found they tasted much better and stored for a long period of time when they didn't have the dirt on them.
Okay.
Seemed to.
And how do you store them?
Well, then when they're all dry, we put them in a gunny sack and put them in our root cellar. And you do, in any root cellaring, even if you're an old hand at it, you need to keep going through those sacks and getting out any that may be rotting. You really need to make sure you don't put ones that look as if they could rot down in the root cellar, and keep looking through your produce down there, or it'll turn the whole sack into something awful.
A new replacement for penicillin. How? What's the temperature of your root cellar in the winter?
Well, we try to keep the root cellar. We have a Celsius thermometer in there, and we try to keep it below 5 degrees, and around 3 or 4 is our. We like that because we're not too close to freezing, yet we're below, that would be below 40 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Between 32 and 40.
Yeah, I think anyone who has a root cellar really needs to invest in the thermometer and really watch it, because that is the secret, is not to either let things get too cool or too warm down there. And then, of course, each vegetable has a slightly different requirements on temperature, and so you can maybe have some on the bottom shelf and some on the top shelf to try to get close to
Could
those
you
requirements.
Give us a little comparison here?
Well,
maybe
I always look it up.
Okay, maybe first you should back up. What are the kinds of vegetables that you keep down there in your root cellar?
Most successful are the ones that grow under the ground, although you can easily store fruit and, of course, tomatoes are above the ground, and they'll store in the root cellar for quite a while. But the root crops are the ones that do best
beets,
for us.
Carrots, potatoes.
Yeah. Last year we stored carrots, and we really were very careful. The whole family monitored the temperature, which helps, if someone else is helping look out for it. And we had delicious carrots in April. Mm-hmm. We finally ate the last of them. So it can be a successful venture, but it does need to be watched.
I was telling Ellen that we sort of by trial and error, and I have we have a daylight basement so that it's partially under the ground, and we live by the river, so it's fairly damp there, and our furnace is housed there but doesn't actually give heat off into the room, but it does just emit enough heat that it keeps it above freezing. And we haven't done it very scientifically, but I think that our daylight basement is slightly warmer than a real root cellar conditions. So we have a fiberglass vat, and we put sand in it and layer the vegetables in that, and they retain that sort of cool temperature. And we cover the vat with styrofoam, one of those heavy styrofoam vats. And we had excellent. The beets were the only things that softened a little bit, but we had potatoes right to the end of April. Carrots, in fact, the carrots were ready to grow again. They were all sprouting. And they wanted to recycle themselves. So So that works. And so I think probably people have a wide variety of conditions, but dry storage, if you do watch it and try and figure out what conditions are.
So you had everything buried in sand, covered
In
sand.
Only because our root cellar isn't as cool as a true root cellar.
Mm-hmm. Probably so, since you had it on the floor, that kept it cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sounds like a good solution.
And kept that styrofoam on it. And we did that with the potatoes and the beets and the carrots, and that worked very well. And we got really spoiled. You would think that a potato is a potato. Well, I suppose not if you come from Idaho. But in fact, when we had to buy a few potatoes between the time ours ran out in May and the time we could start digging new ones, it was really amazing, the difference in the flavor. They really were, the texture was even mushier in the store-bought potatoes. And that's something you would think, well, you don't suffer as much from buying a potato in the store as some of the other vegetables, which you know are very different when you pick them fresh from the garden. But anyway, that works. If anybody, our audience is just not being cooperative tonight here. 474-5044. Either they're disgusted with gardening. They're not going to preserve anything this year. They're going to turn their eye and take a trip when it gets dark to the dumpster with it, or leave it in the garden for the moose. That's another possibility. So we've gone potatoes, tomatoes, green beans. All right.
A couple other things that are fairly hardy that you probably won't have to harvest this evening is your broccoli and cabbage. That can stand a little bit of frost, and I know several years we've kept our broccoli in quite a while after we've had frost, and it just keeps producing. It tends to taste stronger, however, I find, at the end of the season as the frost hits it. So those are the two vegetables you probably can hold off a little bit and get those others in.
Okay. And Brussels sprouts also last very,
that's
very
right.
Well in the...
So they're pretty hardy, and they're not going to nip.
In fact, I think they are. They taste a little. There are a couple of things that they advise you to give them a little frost.
Yeah,
they
say Brussels sprouts is one of those.
Improves the flavor. Persimmons, if you live in Oklahoma. Okay, hello. We do have a caller. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
I just wanted to know, some people are listening to your program.
Great. Do you have a big garden?
This year I didn't plant a big garden because I knew I was going to be gone most of the summer. When I got back, my garden had been taken over by weeds, so the yield is not as strong as usual. But I did have a problem that occurred this year, and I thought maybe someone could help me. I have a rhubarb patch. When I got back, the rhubarb had just gone wild, and there were great big woody stalks that were like 8 feet or so long. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what I can do with my rhubarb patch now. And is it okay if I hang up and listen to you?
It's just fine. Thank you very much for calling, and I'm glad you're out there listening. Good night. We'll try and discuss this rhubarb here.
Okay, I would just as soon have Ray Morgan call her back the first of the week. He's actually a horticulturist in the office and can help him. I'm certain that the rhubarb will be good next year. She might just want to break those stalks off. It sounds like it's seeded or just went to seed. That sounds like what it did, you know. So I think it'll be fine next year. She might just want to leave it. But if she wants to give our office a call on Monday morning, I'm certain Ray can give her the answer to that. Unless, Gail, do you have rhubarb?
Well, I do have rhubarb, and it always wants to do that. And I
some years are worse than others.
Yeah. This may have just been a year, but it does help to break the rhubarb plant up into several different plants and give the extras away to your friends or whatever. And then the next year you'll still get a lot of rhubarb, and it won't tend to go to seed quite as quickly.
So it's something that needs dividing.
Yeah, I think that might... That might be what contributes to this seeding, wanting to go to seed. But those are seeds up there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what is your number, Ellen? And we'll give it again.
Okay, yes, 452-1548 or 452-1530.
So that, and we'll give it again later in the show, but people can call there for a wide variety of excellent advice. So, well, does rhubarb take a little frost or... It's getting...
It's pretty tough this time of the year. I don't think I'd harvest it anymore, probably. Yeah, it can stand a little bit.
Doesn't seem to hurt it much, though. It doesn't flop over like squash does. It takes quite a bit of frost.
That squash, it's amazing. It really, you can really see the differential in plants when you get just a little bit of frost, and you see that certain things, as I said, my dahlias went, and the cosmos is very intolerant of any kind of frost, which is a shame because it's a plant that takes, it's a flower that takes a long time to bloom. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, I have a question about strawberries. This is the second year that I've had strawberry plants, and I really didn't get any fruit at all. And I'm wondering if that's related to the weather or if I was supposed to do something to the plants last year, which I didn't do.
Okay, are these perennial strawberries?
Yes.
She should have got strawberries. I mean, you know, if there were bees around, if she had flowers on the strawberries at all, they certainly should have produced.
I see. I'm using myself as the world's worst example, but here, we put some strawberries in a asparagus patch that we have. Hope springs eternal. The very fact that we're trying to grow asparagus, somewhat Pollyannish, but. At any rate, we had used a lot of horse manure in that patch, thinking that would be great for it. And there was a lot of sawdust in the horse manure, which we found out, and this is going back 4 or 5 years ago, found out is a real nitrogen robber to the soil. We thought we'd largely corrected that problem in that area of our garden, and we put strawberries among the sort of dwindling asparagus. we lose 4 or 5 to frost every winter, despite valiant attempts to cover them and protect them during the year. We started out with 12, now we've got 4. So we put some strawberries there, and they were beautiful plants with real big leaves, and we just had quinults, which are annuals. No strawberries.
Okay, so you've got lots of leaves. Okay,
lots of leaves.
Okay.
So maybe, and again, I'm an amateur, however avid, and I think maybe you've got some kind of imbalance there where you're putting on leaves and are short. You'd have to have your soil analyzed, but maybe you are short for the flower production, which would produce fruit. At least that's a guess. And maybe you can call on Monday morning.
Yes, right. Okay, I think what you said is a possibility because she certainly should have had fruit.
Yeah.
Yeah. This would be a good time to plug soil sampling.
That's right. It's better now. Yes, right after your garden is through producing than trying in the spring because the labs are so busy and then the soil samples get back late.
Mm-hmm. And if you have your soil analyzed now, that in the very early spring when you can first work it at all, then you'll know exactly what it needs and you can put
That's
it
right.
on because you shouldn't do any kind of heavy dressing just before you plant those little plants. So I know people get sort of tired of gardening at this time of year, but the real good gardeners do a lot of work right now in the fall, and that's really what determines a good garden is how good your soil is and whether you're willing to do a little work now. So I advise you all to get your soil tested if you haven't had it done for a while. Is that at all helpful?
One more question. I was wondering if you should, maybe prune back the leaves that are there this year to help next year, but I gather, seeing as no one mentioned that you're not supposed to do that.
Well, are your strawberry plants sending out a lot of runners and new little plants?
Uh-huh.
Those you probably should separate off so that, you'll have to probably take some of them out because there'll be too many now.
I've been doing that.
I don't know what happened to your strawberries.
Oh, well, okay. Well, I was just down in the garden harvesting, and I came back into the house, and I turned the radio on. So maybe there are other gardeners out there who will be listening in shortly.
Yes, their hands are going to get cold very soon.
It's going to be music to pickle beans by here. Okay, thank you. Hello, you're on the air.
I just heard about, I was kind of listening there to the gal talking about strawberries there just a moment ago, and what I do is, about 2 years, I till out the old row. What I do is go right down the row and kind of just alternate the rows every 2 years. In plain language, the runners this year that go into the cultivated part will be next year's plant. That's what I do. I don't know. It seems to I kind of, it's an old thing that's been, I don't know, I learned it a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I do that, and it seems to work. I do have a weed problem. I need to move my patch, but until I do that, I'm still doing the other. But I do that in the fall, and that doesn't, of course, hurt the young plants because mm-hmm. they're not affected. I mean, they're in the middle. I don't touch them.
Do you do any kind of mulching at all of your strawberries so that you can avoid winter die-off?
No, none at all.
Really?
Yeah.
I know that last year was a hard one for some people's perennial strawberry patches because we got some real cold weather without sufficient snow cover.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people, in fact, that had very thriving strawberry patches lost some perennial strawberries.
Now, I had actually real good with it. As a matter of fact, I'm a slow picker, and I don't really like eating strawberries better than picking them.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm an extremely slow picker, and so I tend to give up. I mean, I have so many other things to do in the summertime, going out and picking strawberries every couple of days.
Exactly.
Of course, I'm kind of lax about doing it exactly then because I have so many other things to do. So when I quit picking, I probably let 5 gallons stay on the plants.
Oh, really?
Mm. Oh,
you
yeah,
give us
I put away. Well, I froze about 8, and I thought that was, you know, about my limit as far as I had other things to do. But
I know, it's overwhelming. It,
yeah,
and
I,
it happens all at once.
Yeah, I kind of ended up freezing today, freezing Swiss chard, and
uh-huh.
I looked in the freezer, and I got 11 gallons of that so far. But
that's a good amount.
Oh, and I got rhubarb and beans and peas. I don't have many beans and peas. Beans, of course, just they like warm weather, actually,
they
more so.
They certainly do.
Yeah, and I did get a few, and I've had a few greens beans and canned, I don't know how many pints, but just a few. I mean, very few. And peas, of course, they're even worse because you end up with a big bucket of peas, but when you shell them, you're not really getting that much.
I know. I used to have to shell peas for my grandmother. We used to go visit my grandparents' homestead, and they had a farm 75 miles northwest of Edmonton.
Yeah.
And it would be my job to shell the peas for lunch. And I would, of course, for a 12-year-old, you know, they're fairly intolerant and a little bit of time seems like a lot. But it seemed to me I would shell all morning for what, when it was put on the table at noon, which was a big meal, was a real small bowl of peas. That we solved that by growing sugar snaps so we don't have to shell them. We can eat the pod and the pea. And I really like them. They're sort of a cross between a snow pea and a English pea.
Yeah, I've grown them before, but I didn't care for them too much. I'm
mm-hmm.
kind of a finicky eater, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I just didn't like them as well as I like regular peas. But as far as the amount of work that goes into them is a lot more than beans, if beans will make it that year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, peas will stand a cooler and wet, and
mm-hmm.
they kind of like that. But the thing is, peas aren't the thing you grow for a quick meal, just run out the garden.
No.
I mean, they're awfully good, though, I know that.
They are, and one of the advantages of growing peas is they taste, and they are a vegetable that I just don't think you can buy in the supermarket.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
like
true.
Some of our berry crops. It's just something that you can't get, so you need to grow them if you enjoy them.
Yeah. Well, I didn't get many peas so far this year, and if it freezes, I'll get even less.
mm-hmm. I think they've been slow. I think that we haven't had as many peas.
Yeah,
this
I don't
year.
Know what the deal is. I mean, I got lots of peas, but they haven't filled out yet.
Right.
They're just slower this year, and so I got a few, and I had a few meals with peas, but I only have about 5 meals worth frozen, so
mm-hmm.
It's kind of, you know, last year I think I had, I don't know how much, but quite a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah, I think our pea crop was better. It seemed to start out real well in June this year, but August has been cool, and that's really cut down
things,
the production.
Yeah, it seemed like good weather to begin with,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know, it kind of changed. Celery, of course, likes this weather, but the celery was slower this year, mine was anyway, than it was last year. And so I kind of have little hopes for having nice stalks. I'll probably freeze a little bit of that for making bean soup later this winter. But I cut it up and freeze it.
Oh, I didn't. I've never frozen celery. I even grow celery.
You just dice it up. Like you would rhubarb, or, well, I make my rhubarb into a sauce. I don't freeze it in chunks because being single, I don't make a lot of pies and stuff. So, but I like the sauce just to eat just like it is.
Yeah.
And so
rhubarb sauce is good. And I remember my grandmother used to can a lot of rhubarb sauce. I think that...
Yeah.
Do you do that?
I don't can it. No, I haven't canned anything as far as that goes. I have a canner that I've never used, but I have, and jars too. But I was going to put beans in them.
Expert for Vermont from Vermont. If you heard, he's got all the equipment there. It sounds like he's going out for a pizza. Well, thank you very much for calling.
Well, thank you. I enjoy your show.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye.
Good night. Well. Now I've lost my whole train of thought. We just sort of covered the field and came
the
back
garden.
In.
Yeah. The whole garden, right.
I didn't know that you could freeze celery, though.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that you can go ahead and freeze.
Do you have to blanch that a little
bit? You can dry it. I'd have to check. Most of the things you should blanch or cook beforehand.
Except that you said green peppers.
Yeah, green peppers. Mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
So most everything else. And it's a really good idea to check a resource before you do these things to make sure that the end product is one that's going to be, you know, usable.
It was interesting to me. Both of you have brought to the studio tonight the same book.
Right, right.
Putting Foods By, which is by Ruth Hertzberg, Beatrice Vaughn, and Janet Green. And so obviously both of you think that this is a good resource. Is that?
I really think it is. The one nice thing about it, it not only tells you how to do it, but why. And many times directions will say you do something such and such a way, but then it doesn't explain why you should do it or why you can't. You know, just like directions for making pickles will say, well, don't use iodized salt. Well, why can't you? I mean, and so it answers some of these questions. And for that reason, I think it's a really good book. And one that I use for reference. We also have extension publications that I use for reference, but if you're going to buy a book at the store, I'd say that certainly would be a good one to get.
Yeah, it's my favorite book. And this book may be where I get my tomato chutney recipe from. I'm not sure. It does have a lot of recipes, too. But it's an excellent reference, and it's a very good reference on the root cellaring because it has the temperature and moisture tolerances for each one of the separate vegetables, and they really are separate for each vegetable. They really can't be lumped together. Gives you all sorts of little tips, like don't keep the turnips too long or your house will smell like turnips. And
yeah, right.
Really.
Gail, how do you store your cabbage after you get it out of the garden?
Well, this year we're going to be away, so we've hung our cabbage downstairs, and I'm not sure. I've never tried that before. I hope it works. Yeah, I pulled it out and trimmed the root off, and took off the outer leaves and then hung it. And as per advice in Putting Food By, and but usually we make sauerkraut or something of that sort out of it. Some short-term storage of cabbage just on a shelf in the root cellar, but I prefer the sauerkraut.
Yeah, we make the sauerkraut. You can also dry cabbage, or you can freeze it. But sauerkraut is my first choice.
I think sauerkraut is kind of tricky, and that's where somebody really does need to do the reading. I've made a lot of bad batches of sauerkraut. Had a lot of trouble with not being able to keep it from spoiling right down to the bottom of my pot. You really do need to read, and you need to, again, have that little thermometer and try to keep as close to the temperatures that are recommended as possible. Weigh the salt so you don't get too much in
there. Yeah, and the cabbage also after you grate it. So if you're going to make sauerkraut, you really should invest in a kitchen scale so that you can be really accurate.
The proper ratio of cabbage to salt
that's
is critical.
That's crucial. That's right. And then also grating it, you know, you should have the cabbage fairly even in consistency. Granted, some pieces are going to be bigger than others, but you shouldn't have huge, big leaves in it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The salt will
clearly work. That's quite a process for some people. They even make a tool for slicing cabbage for sauerkraut.
Oh, that's right. You can buy. We have one. It's called a kraut grater.
A kraut grater. With the huge cabbages that a lot of people grow in the interior, mm-hmm. that is probably a very useful thing to have if you get into
it
sauerkraut production.
It's great.
You have one.
We have one. We kind of share it around, and that's maybe, it's a little bit expensive to just have, mm-hmm. and
right.
maybe you might get together with your neighbors and have one because they last forever if you take care of them.
What kind of vessel do you make your sauerkraut in? Is it important to have a crock, do you think? Or
I made it, last year we made it in those white 5-gallon buckets.
Plastic buckets.
We bought new ones so uh-huh. that they really were clean inside. A crock is recommended, but crocks can be really heavy.
And expensive.
And expensive, right. But really heavy. Once you've made sauerkraut in that crock, and if it happens to have gone bad, then you really have a job to get that crock clean again. And so I prefer the white bucket.
Could toss it out or use it for paint.
Yeah, use it for something else. And
uh-huh.
Okay, if you use a white bucket, it should be designed for food use. In other words, you would not buy a garbage bucket.
Yeah.
I had written to Rubbermaid and a couple other people, and they made it very, very clear that their garbage buckets were not designed for making sauerkraut, that it had to be designed for food purposes. So people need to keep that in mind.
No drywall mud mm-hmm. buckets?
No. I prefer the glass jars, and we make them in quart jars or pint jars, and the whole process is through in about a week, and then I have the sauerkraut smell out of my house.
Don't you need to ferment them in a larger...
Yes. No. They ferment just in the quart jars.
Really?
And,
and
this is the way I like to do it. And then, like I said, I'm through with my sauerkraut in about a week's time.
You turn the house into a kraut factory for a 1 week.
Yeah. And I find, like Gail said, temperature is so important. I find that I can control the temperature because I only need to worry about it then for about a week. The ideal temperature is between 68 and 70 degrees. Gail, I think the worst sauerkraut I ever had was one summer I had a workshop, and so we made sauerkraut and I brought it home, and it was a hot summer, and I think my kitchen was like 85 and close to 90, and my sauerkraut was not good. I don't know why, but it was just really hot. It wasn't bad, it fermented, but it wasn't the greatest sauerkraut I ever made. So you can't have it too cold, otherwise the fermenting will stop, and if you have it too mm-hmm. hot, evidently it's not that good either.
Yeah,
so
spoils.
Okay, we've got many critical factors here. We've got evenness of the cutting,
that's right.
the proportion
mm-hmm.
of salt to the kraut, the kind of receptacle, and now temperature. Hello, we have a caller.
Hi, I have a couple questions for you.
Yes.
I have my tomatoes hanging up to dry. Can you give me an idea of how long it'll take before they turn ripe?
Well, if some of them are beginning to look even whitish colored or even a pale orange, mm-hmm. those will ripen quite quickly. Some of the ones that are really a confirmed green may never actually ripen.
Okay. It's like I'm going to have a lot of chutney this winter.
But it's worth giving them a try, and you can just keep track of their condition because they're hanging right there, probably right in front of your eyes. your hair.
The other question I have some pumpkins, and I haven't grown them before. Should I bring them in tonight?
Yeah, I would say you should.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anything in a squash.
Once they're nipped, you know.
Okay, and also a lot of rhubarb. Is there any way to freeze it without going ahead and making it into bread or sauce?
You could just go ahead and harvest it. I wonder if it isn't awful tough this time of the year. You might try it. Does it snap fairly easy?
Yeah, there were some fairly small shoots that seemed to snap pretty well.
Okay. Yeah, just go ahead and take them in. I just wash them well and cut them into cubes or however you're going to use them, and then just put them in freezer bags in the freezer.
You don't put any little sugar in it?
No, I don't. The reason I don't do that, then it kind of gives me lots of options for using them later. If you add sugar mm-hmm. to them, you need to keep track of how much, and then if you add to them to a sauce, I just freeze them as is. I don't add any sugar to them.
So rhubarb doesn't have to have any pre-treatment.
You can pre-treat it, and perhaps actually keeps a little bit better. But if you're pressed for time, you can do it, and then you probably won't want to hold it more than a month or two before you do something with it.
One last question. Anything to do with radishes at this point?
You have radishes now?
I have lots and lots of radishes sitting in the garden. I planted a late batch of them over there.
I guess. How did they do?
Just fine. They kind of had an odd shape. They're oblong, and they tend to pop up out of the garden. Their little heads are sticking up.
Oh, you mean the radish itself came out?
Yeah.
Well, that's very interesting. Maybe we should try radishes late rather than early, because we've really had a problem with them going to seed if you plant them early. They look like they're coming right along. Well, they're very light sensitive, actually. And so our excessive light, not excessive, our proper amount of light in June really causes radishes to bolt. And so maybe that's a better late crop. What do you do with radishes? I think you need to eat them in salads.
Just store them in the refrigerator. They'll store for a while.
There really
isn't much else you can do with them.
Take a radish to a friend.
I have lots and lots. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night.
There's another good reason to have some late crops of radishes, and you can have an early crop and then pull them up and have another crop, and that is they won't get the root maggot if they're planted late. Because that little fly isn't around to lay its eggs, and so you have much nicer radishes late, too. Not quite so many little white things in them.
Get them off cycle with the with that fly. Well, that's
true of onions, too. We also planted early and late onions, and we also were not bothered with that insect.
I didn't know onions were bothered by a maggot.
Ours are always. This year, however, we really were lucky, but for many years, we just didn't even plant them.
We've actually banned them from our garden. Because we really don't. That is one of the pure pleasures, I think, of having gardened in the South and gardened in the Midwest and now gardening in Alaska. One of the real wonderful things about it is you really don't have much insect problems up here compared to other places.
Right.
But onions seem to be real attractors of that problem. Yeah. And so we decided, well, we won't bother with them right now. And in fact, our problems have been less since then. Mm-hmm. It's like eggplants seem to attract aphids. And eggplants is sort of curious thing. I noticed at the fair this year, I wonder if anyone, a mature, albeit tiny, artichoke.
Hmm. Wow.
I was so impressed.
I think there are some growing in the experimental farm gardens.
Yeah. I know, but we won't measure ourselves by them.
Maybe somebody else has tried anyway.
I actually was talking to someone the other night, and they said that the experimental farm is developing a giant broccoli to go along with giant cabbages. I don't know if there's anybody out there who knows about the giant broccolis. They're supposed to be available, I think, next spring, or at least that was the rumor. So if anybody knows about the giant broccolis, they could call 474-5044 and tell us. Does anyone know out there, I was sort of thinking all the cauliflower and all the and all the broccoli seems to come to fruit at the same time. And I was wondering, do you think by staggering the planting, does it all even out and still mature at the same time, or does it?
Well, I can answer that question. I did two different plantings of cauliflower this year. One that I started pretty late. I think I didn't plant those seeds until May. You know, I planted them inside still. And then some that were started much earlier, probably 4 weeks earlier. And the ones I planted in May are just right now flowering, and we ate the rest of them long time ago.
So
we can't even remember anymore.
So, in fact, it does help to stagger that.
So you could stagger your planting and not be overrun with mature plants.
Well, that's a good idea because, it's sort of nice, but this incredible bounty that exists right now is just a little bit overwhelming. I mean, it doesn't seem that way when you put all those tender little shoots into the garden in June. But now the thing is you sort of feel like you're going to be eaten by vegetables rather than the reverse. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I have a question about Swiss chard.
Uh-huh.
How cold will they take? How much cold will they take?
Quite a bit, but they get kind of tough, not quite as nice tasting as they were when they were nice and tender, but I've picked Swiss chard in the snow, and it was still good, just trying to prolong my garden's productivity.
I've seen them with really little ice on them, and then the sun comes out and it warms up and they seem to keep growing. It's quite amazing. They can really take take some frost parsnips. We've grown parsnips this year. I don't know what kind of a crop it's going to be, but I understand that they can stay in the garden for quite some time and can take some frost.
Yeah, yeah, they're one of the things that down south books recommend leaving in the garden over the winter, but of course we can't quite do that.
And same thing with carrots, too. You can leave them in for quite a while, can't you?
Yeah, and as long as the tops don't
freeze. That's right.
Freeze.
Yeah, if you have the carrot tops sticking out of the ground, of course, they're going to get nipped and they're going to get soft. But if they're underneath the ground, I would say get your other things harvested and just wait a little while with your carrots.
Mm-hmm. And there isn't such a high water content in the tops of carrots. And so, of course, they're not nearly as likely to freeze as some of the other things. So that takes a little more to stop them in their tracks.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Boy, we haven't been doing this in a very orderly fashion, which is fine with me. I feel that way about the garden. You sort of just run around, and everything needs attention right now. For anyone who has any broccoli and cauliflower and/or cauliflower left, that is best frozen. That's correct.
Right. Yeah, yes, but not in the garden. I mean, you know.
Right. Yes, we're right at the point now. Nothing, as we said earlier, you shouldn't try and freeze anything on the stalk.
This isn't the way to do it necessarily, but one lady one year had forgot to harvest all her potatoes, and of course they were froze solid in the ground. And what I suggested she do, and I guess this did work, is she just dug them out of the ground and then just had the pot of boiling water and just dumped them in. It wasn't ideal, but at least she didn't lose them then anyway.
So they had a big meal.
Well, yeah, whenever she needed the potatoes.
Oh, she dug them out as she needed them.
Yeah, she dug them out as she needed them. Well, you know, what are you going to do? Once they're there, you can't very well thaw them out.
That's interesting.
I don't recommend that, however, but if it should happen to someone.
Okay.
A really delicious thing to do with broccoli if people have food dryers is to dry it. It has to be blanched just as if it were going into the freezer. But then you cut it up in small enough pieces to dry readily, and it's better than potato chips.
Really?
It's really good.
What is the critical thing with drying? I mean, must you go out and purchase a fancy food dryer? Is there any way that you can simulate? That's probably the best.
Well, I think you can dry on a rack over your wood stove or wherever, but for really nice quality results, you probably get better quality results from a food dryer. What do you think, Ellen?
I don't think you need to buy a food dryer necessarily. Maybe you'd have controlled temperature. It's best when you dry things that the temperature be about, maybe 120. You don't want it too terribly high. And if you're going to do, one of the things that is easy to do just in a warm house are parsley. You just pick them and tie them together and put a brown paper bag over them and just hang them on the ceiling, near the ceiling, or down in the furnace room. And they dry very well. And the reason for the brown paper bag is so that they won't discolor, and they seem to keep their aroma better if they're dried without the exposure to light.
Most things that you're drying do not like direct sunlight.
The things will dry all right in direct sunlight, but your herbs and your spices really don't, because they lose a lot of their aroma if you do that.
I had a caller, and somehow I lost it. Maybe we were talking about...
But drying in an electric oven is extremely costly. If you have a gas stove and you have a pilot light, you can dry in there, or like Gail said, over the wood stove. That certainly would be a good way to do it, but... drying in your electric oven is very costly and really not a very good method to use.
It's that. Like the fellow from Vermont who
oh, right,
put 75
yeah.
dried tomatoes in his garden. He said, you missed the scale, but he said you can fit 75 dried tomatoes into a quart, and once you've tasted them, you'll decide that they are better off left in that jar. I think you have... all of us need to do a little trial and error. What seems to work for one person doesn't work for another, and it's hard to give advice because not everybody has the same conditions. Even root cellars vary, and so you have to do a little trial and error. And I hope that the audience is a little better than I am at keeping track of the recipes and methods that you do use, because I will come up with wonderful solutions and then not have any clue as to which recipe it was. You think, in this sort of frenzy of preserving, you think, well, I'll remember that, but in fact you don't. So you might be advised to keep some fairly careful record. So if something doesn't work, you will know that maybe you shouldn't try that again. And conversely, if something does work.
Or if your family doesn't like it, of course, they'll probably let you know, and you'll know not to use that method again.
If you remember what method.
Well, you know, some families really like, for instance, canned beans and don't like them frozen or vice versa. And so you'll remember that quite readily, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one nice thing about the canning jars with the lids, the dome lids, that you can write right on them, you know, what method you followed. And then that'll remind you next December.
Mm-hmm. Are there some things here that we have all these extensive notes? Sugar snap peas should be frozen. They are mushy if they're canned.
That's
if
right,
they're
if they're canned.
Canned.
Uh-huh.
I think we pretty much covered cabbage. We haven't talked about beets at all.
A couple of choices on beets, actually. You can store them, like Gail said, in your root cellar. You can can them. If you use them as vegetable, then you need to use a pressure canner because they're low acid. If you pickle them, then they're high acid, and you can use the water bath method. They also can be frozen. So there's a number of choices of ways to preserve beets.
We dry stored them, and they make wonderful borscht, even if they do get a little soft, and that tastes wonderful in the cold winter. Also, we can't leave a program off like this without talking about zucchini just a little bit.
Oh.
A little bit. That seems to be the thing. It's just overwhelming. You know, I have just baseball bats-sized zucchinis, and the refrigerator's taken up with them. And what is your advice on zucchini, both either of you?
You mean storing it, eating it, or what? Mm-hmm. Or doing what with it?
What do you do with it? What do you do with it, Ellen?
Give it away. No, we eat lots and lots of it. We like the bread and butter pickles that you can make. Those would be made from the smaller zucchini. You can go ahead and freeze them. You can can them, too, and you either like or dislike that. They're probably best canned with some tomatoes or something like
right,
you would buy at
that.
The store. So you have some choices. But again, the huge, gigantic ones, even though they're fun to grow, they're really not nearly as usable as a smaller one.
That's true, but they get away from you. I mean, you go out there and you forget a couple of days, and you come and you look, and there they are. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, is there any way that you can freeze leeks? Or do you put them in a root cellar? This is the first year I've ever grown them, and I don't really know how to...
They're both grabbing the book. I don't know. While they look up the answer here, I have not personally grown leeks. Was it a good crop for you this year?
Yeah, they did really well. They were real slow getting started, but now they look like really nice leeks.
Well, it's a very elegant vegetable and makes wonderful soup. So the very least you could do is to make some wonderful leek soup, and that I know would freeze well. And then
most
that would
of those
be all set.
Have a milk base, though, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Can you freeze something with a milk base?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you can't?
No.
See, it says root cellar. Only
oh, they're
here.
Looking root cellar only.
Okay. That's sort of what I thought, since I don't have a root cellar.
Do you dry them a little bit before?
You could go ahead and dry them if you wanted to. You'd handle them kind of like onions. Also, onions really do not freeze very well, so my guess was that leeks wouldn't freeze very well either. So if you have some place to store them. Do we have just a minute? Do you want to talk about something else, Patty? We can look up the directions. You said you don't have a root cellar, though, to store them in, do you?
Well, not really. It's not very well temperature controlled.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can try. Though I would imagine they have a fairly good shelf life. I mean, it's not going to last you until March, but perhaps, I mean, I think that they would last for a while. I don't think that they're something that, like broccoli or cauliflower, you really can't keep them around the house too long. But I would imagine you've got a little time here and have a lot of elegant leek soups and braised leeks and enjoy them now. I've banned all meat protein from the house now so that people can eat vegetables nonstop. And I think that's what everybody's going to have to do for a few weeks. We're really going to appreciate that those tastes come January when it's harder to get. And they're both still looking.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Patty, if we have a moment, I'd like to mention one thing that we discovered last year. And again, it was a recipe in this Putting Food By book, and that is sauerkrauting turnips, grating turnips and sauerkrauting. It's just delicious, most wonderful stuff you ever had. It's called Sauer Reuben.
Oh, good. All right, anyone who's got a turnip crop out there, look up the recipe for...
It's the same process as the sauerkraut, right. Except you have to grate the turnips.
Okay.
Since they...
And for any more questions, call the Extension Service. There are lots of experts in town. I've really enjoyed this program. Got me over my butterflies coming back here after a couple of months' absence. I hope you have a very nice, busy 2 days here putting your foods by, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you. This is Home Fires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. Our executive producer has been Carla Tonella.
You're listening to KUAC FM in Fairbanks. It's 8 o'clock and time now for a Prairie Home Companion, local broadcast of which is made possible by contributions from KUAC listener sponsors.
From Minnesota Public Radio.
Coming through that door, I think we met somewhere before. Hello, love. Hello, love. Well, where in the world you been so long? I missed you so since you've been gone. Hello, love. Oh, hello, everybody, and welcome to a Prairie Home Companion. Coming to you live from the Orpheum Theater in downtown St. Paul and presented every Saturday night at this time by Minnesota Public Radio and by this public radio station. With Mary Bergen's little band here from Ireland going to play for you, Robin and Linda Williams here from Virginia, Mr. Peter Struschko, John Foster back there on the bass, Mr. Greg Brown, Philip Brunel coming up at the piano with Mr. Vern Sutton and Ms. Janice Hardy, brought to you by your friends in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, and those biscuits, oh, they're tasty and expeditious. Hello, love. Hello, love. Oh, thank you there, kids. Hello to you on a Saturday night. Welcome to our show, this first portion of our show, brought to you by Powder Milk Biscuits in the big blue box. Kind of missing the piano here tonight on the opening theme. Butch Thompson and the trio are not with us. It was months ago, I guess, months ago that Butch asked if they could take off on August the 25th, go out and play a job out in Pennsylvania near Philadelphia tonight. And we said, sure, go ahead, it's all right. Leave us, don't worry about us. And I thought they were kidding. I never thought that they were going to actually do it. But they're out there. And I don't mean to make them feel guilty. I hope that they have a wonderful, wonderful time tonight. But here's a little song that I wrote for Butch and Bill and Red out there in the big time in Pennsylvania. Doing his show at the old microphone, there stood an announcer who was lost and alone. His friends had departed, just got up and flown, and left him alone at the old microphone. His face was all wrinkled, his hair white as snow. The folks could not see it on their radio, but they heard the tears in his sad baritone, standing alone at the old microphone. But he was a trooper, do you think he would say? My heart is broken 'cause they left me? No way. He just slapped on some makeup, some paint and cologne, and stood there alone at that old microphone. His friends, they got an offer to fly to PA and perform for the rich at a gala soiree. Though he'd worked his fingers right down to the bone to provide things for them, they just left him alone. They tuned in the show from their black limousine. Those friends who ran off 'cause the money looked green. They'd gone for the glamour, the glory, the glitter, and left him alone with his mic and transmitter. He sang his old theme song. It sounded so thin. His voice drifted off from the key it was in. He stopped for a moment, then said, "I'm all right." And Butch said, "Let's cancel that concert tonight." They chartered a plane and they flew away west. They feared for the worst and they hoped for the best. And they thought as they entered the central time zone of him standing alone at the old microphone. They jumped in a taxi and Bill Evans said, "We owe him so much. He's our father," said Red. "How could we leave him? Though we are full grown, standing alone at that old microphone." Imagine the horror and anguish that tore at their hearts as they opened that studio door. They cursed and they wept, oh, if only they'd known. The show was on tape, there was no microphone. Remember this story the next time you hear the voice of somebody who weeps in his beer. Before you feel guilty and cancel your fun, make sure that it's him and not a rerun.
That's for Butch out there. Have a good time tonight, boys. That's for Greg Brown. Come on up here. Let's get this show started and do a quick one here for us. All right, kick us out.
That little is a little low. You love me, but you don't anymore. Gotta step it up and go. Go. Can't stand fighting her today. Gotta step it up and go. That little lady about 4 feet tall. Give you just a little as you want and all. You gotta step it up and go.
Yeah.
Can't stand fighting her today. Gotta step it up and go. New little lady sitting on stage trying to make a living from putting on air. You gotta step it up and go.